Secretary of State budget. We're in phase two, and we have Jen Coney, Director of Human Resources, and Kathy Polino, Director of Audits, Conference Act, Director of Elections and Provisions, and Roy Turnbaugh, State Archivist. So we'll begin the public hearing, please.
Good morning. Chair Morris, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jen Coney. I am the Human Resources Division Director for the Secretary of State's office. This morning, I'd just like to tell you a little bit about what my division does, our performance measures, and then our budget request. The Human Resources Division at the Secretary of State's office provides human resources services consisting of advice and assistance in the interpretation and application of state and federal laws, Secretary of State's policies and procedures, maintaining a complete confidential personnel record system, and monitoring human resource management activities in the agency. Our division services consist of policy development, implementation and compliance, recruitment and selection, employee discipline and grievance, dispute resolution, performance management, agency-wide training, compensation and compensation, affirmative action, planning and monitoring, employee orientation and benefits, employee records, and employee layoff and outplacement assistance. Our division is funded with a general fund, other fund split, and that's based on an FTE allocation of the other divisions within the agency. The division has two performance measures, as you'll see in your binders. Our first performance measure is around affirmative action. And, of course, the outcome that we desire there is to have more women, people of color, and persons with disabilities recruited, hired, and retained in the agency, reflecting more accurately the diversity of the state of Oregon. Our second performance measure is around the services we provide our customers. We are one of four internal support divisions within the agency. Our customers, for the most part, are the other divisions within the agency. We do an annual survey, anonymous survey online of our customers, and then the division reviews the results and addresses problems or concerns that arise. We have one program option package. POP 181 provides a reclassification of the agency's training coordinator from an office specialist 2 to a training development specialist 2 to reflect the duties that are currently being performed. This position has evolved over the last few years, and this was requested in the 03-05 budget but was withdrawn by the agency due to funding restrictions. The package is funded through an increase of other fund limitations and a reduction in general fund. And that's all I have for you this morning. Happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you very much. First of all, to the Secretary and your staff, I apologize for being late. And colleagues, this was just one of those mornings. I'm sorry. Any questions?
Yes.
Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I noticed that the Executive Office is proposing an increase of approximately 1.5%, actually going back to 0103, which would indicate managing things pretty well, no change in FTE. The business services over the same time period increasing 13%, but yet the personnel resources is proposing a 14.8% increase over the 0305 period. Wondering maybe if you could elaborate on why the differences within those departments.
I believe that the reason behind the increase would be solely related to this this recent classification. The division is very small. We have three FTE. Most of the budget is dedicated to salaries. So it's my best guess that is about this reclassification, the increase.
Mr. Secretary, do you have something to add?
No, I just agree with that. It's a very small division, so the percentage increase is not specifically, not very representative when you have three FTE.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for your presentation, and thank you for being so accommodating. We didn't get to you yesterday, and it was nice of you to come back.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Good. So I think we'll invite Ms. Polino back up and ask Monica to make a couple of comments apropos yesterday. You might, for the benefit of the members that weren't here, just give a quick summary of what we did yesterday and then call attention to the memorandum.
Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, yesterday we had testimony from legislative counsel come down and talk about the scope of the constitutional authority of the audits division. And there were several questions put forth on how far the exclusive authority of the division extends. So ledge counsel Ted Rutlinger went back and did a little research, and you have a memo before you or an email before you this morning basically clarifying some of his statements from yesterday that he does not believe that the authority, the exclusive authority, extends all the way down to local government. It extends to the only to state resources. So that memo is before you. I think they got through most of their overview of the audits division, but we held off since House members needed to leave early for floor session, held off on a discussion of policy packages. So I think that that is where we are today. And there are a couple of other pieces of information that were at your place sitting today, and I think Ms. Polino will talk about those.
Good. Thank you, Ms. Polino. I'm sorry that we didn't get finished yesterday. I hadn't seen this prior to coming in this morning. You have probably had a chance to review it since the committee started. Do you have any comments?
Madam Chair, no, that's very consistent with our understanding of our responsibilities. So.
Okay. Then, just as the professional staff indicated, we had left off on the discussion of the policy option packages that seemed to be a more appropriate subject for the entire committee. And so I would ask you to take up where you left off yesterday with that discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, Kathy Polino with the Secretary of State Audits Division. I'll just briefly describe the two handouts. They were information that you asked me to bring back at this meeting. The one is that copy that I was reading from our audit Bible, the government audit standards. So that section I was reading on accountability is here, and that's for your information.
Thank you.
And then the second piece, you asked, Madam Chair, about our audit queue. And this needs some explanation because this is one of those things that when I got back to my office, you know, my staff, if they were here, they would have been kicking me under the table because the queue is right now in the middle of process. Every 6 months we go through this process of resetting our queue. So maybe if I could just take 1 minute to explain the process that we go through and the stage that this particular queue is at.
Please.
We have what we call our audit tracking database, and you can see in here this is just a printout of the various items that are in our audit tracking queue, and you know there's over 200 items that are in here. As our auditors are out at state agencies and they identify things that maybe are potential questions or things that come up, they enter it into this audit queue. If we get questions from legislators or interested parties, if there are items that come through our hotline that aren't necessarily investigations but maybe potentially good audit topics, those get loaded into this tracking database for us so that we don't lose track of those ideas. And then every 6 months we sit down, we go through this tracking queue and pull out some of the issues that look like good potential issues, and then we go through it.
Let me interrupt you. Who's the we that
we
sits
are,
down?
We pull together some of our audit staff to specifically focus in on this, our senior auditors that are in our office. We then go through and establish a process where we will sit down and meet with legislative fiscal office, budget management. We try to interview as many people as we can to get some idea of the topics that are of interest to other folks, pull all of those items in, and then they go through this process that we use to sort and prioritize. This list that you have before you is the beginning of the list. We are currently having those meetings and doing the scanning to add to this list. And then where it will go from here is we will have some of our staff do a little bit more refinement of what the audit question is, ask a few questions of the agencies, gather a little bit more information, and then we have our audit management team go through and rank these, and you can see the criteria that we use. You know, is there potential for significant cost savings? Are there known problems already in these agencies? And we go through this process of ranking them, sorting them, and then we develop a list of about 20 audit topics that come out of this, have them in our queue, and then we schedule those as they come available. Every 6 months, we take what's left in the queue and reassess it and prioritize it with new topics coming up all the time. So there isn't a single list that's there all the time. It's kind of a fluid list, but this is where we're at in this process.
Thank you for that explanation. I would assume that Legislative direction, though, might move to the front of the queue, mm-hmm. or do you track those separately? Does a list exist that said this is the result of the last legislative session that specifically gave us instruction to do certain audit work?
Madam Chair, we don't have a separate list. It gets included in with the others, but we do track specifically if a bill or some other kind of something else was passed and there was a mandate for us to do a specific audit. Those we do track separately. We have a list of mandated audits, which are both mandates from the federal government, mandates from the legislature. So, yes, we do have a list of statutorily required audits that we do track.
Is that available?
Yes, we could get that.
I'm trying to ascertain two things. First of all, the volume that is coming from legislative direction or federal direction. I hadn't really thought of federal direction until you just now brought it up.
Right.
But the amount that comes from legislative direction. And then I guess the question that naturally flows from that is, how do you, in addition to all of the other work that you're trying to discharge, both the work that you would routinely do, work that you all would initiate yourselves based on information that would come from any of these sources that you detail, how do you do the timing? Let's assume the legislature says you will audit XYZ. And how responsive are you time-wise in getting back to that legislative direction?
Madam Chair, that is a great question because that's one of the most difficult things we have because we do have a staff with lots of different kinds of technical expertise, and you need to match the staff and when they're available with the specific request to make sure that we have the right competencies on each particular engagement. But what we do when we're establishing our audit plan is we sit down and we take our list of all of our mandates and lay those out on the audit plan that, you know, all of those get done first. And, you know, our statewide financial audit work is usually our bedrock, and that gets set first and scheduled in, especially because those have specific time deadlines. And then we look at other mandates to see if there is another sort of deadline involved with those. Let's say there's a hearing at a certain point in time that we want to have some information by. We will set that timeline and then work backwards and establish our plan. And then really the rest of this, you know, these great other audit areas that we have, is used with what's left in our audit staff budget. So
when we kicked off this session, mm-hmm. had you completed all of the work that was asked for statutorily last session?
Madam Chair, yes, except for there's one outstanding was a contract audit for a pharmacy benefit administrator audit that was done. There was money put in our budget to get that done this last year. It was one that we were contracting out with a private firm. We have a preliminary draft report, and it's in, and I think they expect to finalize it soon. That is one that just ran into problems all the way along in the process. So that is still outstanding, but it should be done very soon.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Thompson. Good morning.
Hi.
In this building, we have 90 legislators with broad backgrounds, and they all come in with different talents and different traits and different attributes. Mine happens to be commercial finance, and so when I read an audit, I think I know what I'm reading. Is there a way when an audit is published to maybe put together a bullet sheet with them that identify key findings? You know, when I open an audit, first thing I do is turn to the management letter, go straight to the back, and that's what I'm looking for. Is there a way to create something like that so other members in the building who have other strong attributes, but, you know, looking at financials isn't one of them, we can help them?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, yes, and I think with the exception of our financial statement opinion audits, that is our goal of every other audit that we have is we have a summary that's at the very beginning,
right,
that is written in language that we think everybody in the world should be able to understand. When you get back into the details of the report, sometimes it gets a little bit more technical, but that summary, and it's never more than that first page, is intended to kind of give the high level.
But what about on the financials? I think that's a foreign language to a lot of people in this building.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, you know, there is some really good models out there of what some other states have done in that area. We haven't really heard anybody asking us to digest the financial information in that way, but that is something that we are very willing to take a look at if it's useful to people.
It's just an idea to to further disseminate information to all the members.
One other thing following on that line of questioning that could be useful is I know you're turning out audit reports all the time. And for people who are knowledgeable about how to get those from your office, they're easy to get. It might be you've extended a courtesy to legislators that you notify us by email every time a petition is beginning to move, and that's been very helpful. But you might think about a broadcast email to the legislature saying on this date the audits division has issued audit findings on the XYZ. And it would be just as complicated as one sentence. And if you, also directions on how to find it. If you want a hard copy, come over to the office. If you want to email, press here.
Yeah. And, Madam Chair, we do have an email notification that goes out. We've included normally members of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, members of Legislative Fiscal, and those folks. And, I mean, I think that's a great idea to expand it to
I would very members. Much like to expand it to all 90 because I might be assuming a seat on a committee and have be a new committee to me and have no idea that within the last 6 months you produced an audit report that I would like to peruse at my leisure to come up to speed.
Madam Chair, that would be very simple for us to do because we already have that email list. So.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morsett.
Thank you. I'm interested in the only audit that you haven't completed yet. That's the PBM.
Senator Morsett, I'm going to ask PBM.
That's the drug purchasing program. It's the
pharmacy benefit manager.
Now, I understand that we have hired a pharmacy benefit manager for the state bulk purchasing program, but I also understand, and I visited with a gentleman from out of state who is here to talk to PEB about the Public Employee Benefit Board about being a pharmacy benefit manager also. So I'm interested in where you are on that particular audit. Have we indeed hired someone, and are you auditing? What's the purpose of that audit?
Madam Chair, Senator Morsett, that audit is basically done. They're just in the process of finalizing it and getting feedback from the pharmacy benefit manager. And, you know, without divulging all the findings, because I can't talk about it until it is completely finalized, but there really wasn't significant problems found during the course of that audit. They were looking at drug claims and rebates that are being handled by this pharmacy benefit manager. And, you know, I would assume they're going to be done very soon. You know, we hope to have that.
Well, you just raised a point of interest. So at some point I'd like to see the results of that.
And you will be on our email list.
Okay,
so
thank
we'll
you.
Get that.
Your exchange with Senator Morsett causes me to have a question as well. Earlier today you talked about competencies for each engagement, and an outside auditing firm has been doing this work on the pharmaceutical, if I understood you correctly. That seems to me to be a very esoteric area. Yesterday you made a point of saying that you seek these firms with competencies. How were you able to find a firm that had prior experience in doing this kind of work with the adequate competencies for the engagement?
Madam Chair, one of the scoring criteria we were looking at as part of their request for proposal was whether they had experience doing similar types of studies. And this particular one actually was, you know, a very straightforward looking at the controls over claims processing and rebates. But we did look for a firm that had experience looking at similar types of systems, either in other states or here in Oregon.
So the firm that, who are you at liberty to disclose who the firm was?
Moss Adams, they're a very good.
So Moss Adams then had experience in doing these kind of pharmacy benefit audits.
Similar studies to this, yes.
Similar, like the same kind of, when you say similar, how?
Madam Chair, I'd have to go back and look at all of their prior experience, but I know that is one of the criteria we were looking at when we were scoring them, was do they have the types of background in order to do this work, and they were a firm that was very qualified to do it, but I would have to look at specifically what their past experience is. I don't
And the genesis of this audit was what?
Madam Chair, my understanding is last session there were some questions about the pharmacy benefit manager and whether they were properly assessing claims and rebates on behalf of the state of Oregon. And so that was a question that came up. The bill to really look at that never passed, but at the very end of our budget, some money was put in our budget to get that work done. And so that's so we went about contracting for and getting the money to do this.
And one last question, I'm just curious. You indicated, and I know that there are strictures about what you can say about the audit, but you did just say that there were no significant findings. What do we pay for an audit like that that yields no significant findings?
Madam Chair, there was a lot of work that had to go into this particular review because it was a lot of detail work, and then they also had to do some information systems reviews because a lot of this, the claims processing was automated. This particular, we had budgeted $100,000 to do this review, and it's going to come in under that. I think it's probably in the neighborhood of $75,000.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morsett.
One of the difficulties, I guess, in dealing with the pharmacy benefit manager is trying to figure out how much money they keep for doing the transaction and getting the rebate from the drug companies, and that has proven to be a very lucrative business for some firms that do that. So what we're looking for is transparency. We want to know when they bargain down the price of drugs for the particular entity, how much of that they keep for themselves, and that can be significant, and I think that's what we're looking at.
Madam Chair, Senator Morrison, I think one of the things is as we were managing this contract, there were questions that we had that were different than the questions that were asked of us to have audited, and you'll see that we still have on this the list that you have, number 16, pharmacy reimbursement. There are some questions in our mind still about a different piece of that that came up during the course of the audit that we had questions about that weren't specifically the questions that the body had questions on. So we're going to continue looking down that line and you know, we'll talk to you about that.
Okay. Thanks.
Great. Well, now that we've interrupted you 66 times, I'm going to ask you to come back to your policy option packages, please.
Madam Chair, I will go through these really quickly. What these are areas that we feel that additional accountability over the use of public funds is really needed, but we really don't have the resources to cover them adequately. We talked a little bit about that first pop. I'm back on your list, priority list. I think it's the second to the last page on the fraud investigation pop. We talked about that a little bit yesterday. Again, state police has some cases that they're handling that they could really use some additional help. And we've had a really good marriage between our office and their office in those investigations. And, you know, some of the very exciting things, just yesterday we got a whole ton of information in, and I want to talk to you about it, but I can't yet. But hopefully soon we'll be able to tell you about this one particular investigation. You know, auditors are weird that we think things are good when they're bad. But we'll share that with you as soon as we can. But we also have another whole list of things that came up during the course of our data mining where we see different kinds of transactions and things that look really suspicious, and they're ones that somebody really does need to track these things down and take a look at them. So that's that first pop is adding resources to both work on those investigations and to track down the stuff that looks funny to us.
Senator Morris.
This is the only division or agency I know of that bad news is good news.
In a sick kind of way. Afraid to admit. The next pop is titled Legislatively Requested Audits. This is one, and Madam Chair, it kind of tails on some of the conversation you were talking about. Every session, ideas come up, bills go through, and you know, we are very interested in answering some of those questions that are out there. The Joint Legislative Audit Committee was set up in statute to take those requests, prioritize them, and then work with us and with Legislative Fiscal to meet those information needs. There are probably some very, very good audit topics that when we go through and assess them may not match up with our criteria for what's important, but may nevertheless be very important information for all of you to make your decisions. So what we are hoping to do with this pop is just set aside a certain number of hours that would be available, and you can make it as big or as small as you'd like it to be. We just proposed three FTE to do audits at the request of the legislature and have the Joint Legislative Audit Committee process actually go through and do, you know, as their responsibility in statute is to take those, prioritize them, and then work with us to get those audits done. That process, I don't think, has reached its full potential yet. And so we're hoping to say, you know, here are some hours that are yours to decide what's important as far as audits, as opposed to continually going through, placing them in bills, and then having to go through that process of
Representative Smith. Intriguing idea. Right now I'm still open to the idea. I need help, though, and maybe you said it and I just missed it. What's the definition of the audit? What type of audits are we talking about?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, that would be what the Joint Legislative Audit Committee would decide, whether if there was a particular question they wanted to have answered, if there was a audit topic or idea that they wanted to have. You know, we have a specific agency. We'd like someone to go in and take a look at them and see, we have some questions, we're not sure. Or if there is maybe some information you receive from an agency and you want someone to go in and attest and validate that the information is accurate and reliable, those are the kinds of things that we envision having those hours set aside to do that kind of work.
So just some clear follow-up. So it could be anything from a financial audit to a performance audit to asking and answering a specific question.
That's correct.
Thank you.
I want to talk a little bit more about the gatekeeper on that. Mm-hmm. We all get lots of information from agencies, and I think from time to time all of us have said, I wonder how true this is. I wonder, have I asked the question properly to get the answer that I wanted for my specific question? What's the gatekeeper? The Joint Audit Committee?
Madam Chair, that's my hope, is that would be a gatekeeper, because we do get individual requests right now. And the way that I would like to see it working would be to have those all get vetted through some sort of process. And the Joint Legislative Audit Committee is one that's already established in statute. It's, you know, it's a committee that's made up of both House and Senate members. And, you know, if that committee can serve that capacity, I think that could really enhance the audit function in the state of Oregon. Just with this 3 FTE, that translates somewhere roughly around 9,000 audit hours that would be available to meet any of those kinds of questions that come up or other needs. So I guess we had this proposal in our budget a long time ago, and I guess even before House Bill 2001 came up as creating its own legislative audit function. So I think we all see there's a need here, and I guess this is our proposal on how to address that.
I want to go back to the fraud for just a second, only because fraud's a pretty wide term, and you alluded to something that obviously piqued our curiosity, but I'd like to try to winnow down a little bit what you mean by fraud.
Okay.
Election fraud, misappropriation of public money, what?
Right. We're looking specifically at loss of public funds, and usually it's at a state employee that is perpetrating that fraud. So purchases that maybe may not be furthering the business of the state of Oregon. It could be, cash that's being stolen. We have a lot of cash in the state that comes in through very small agencies, boards. We had an investigation a long time ago out at the coast, the Hatfield Marine Science Center, you know, the donation box you drop your money in as you were going. Well, the gal running the bookstore out there was taking some of that money, and no one would ever know. I mean, how do you know how much donations come in at any particular time? But there's all kinds of that around the state of Oregon. So specifically, we're looking at helping to further process that. The state police has their criminal investigation unit, and some of the cases they're dealing with are those state employees that are misappropriating funds.
Why isn't this a state police function?
Madam Chair, it is, and again, if you'll remember, we all have a slightly different role in this. State police does have an investigation function on this, and we work very closely with them. But our role is a little bit differently. We have kind of the two pieces to it. One is making sure that the full extent of the loss is covered. And one of the examples we're working on right now, state police had some information on one of the employees, and they were ready to go ahead and prosecute and go down that path. Well, we went in and did some additional work looking through the invoices, looking through the books, and it's nearly nearly almost quadrupled the amount of money that this person took. And so now they're going to go after the entire amount instead of just the amount they had and were ready to go with. And then kind of that second piece is our job is really the only one to go in and look at the controls over how these things were able to take place in the first place so that we can prevent that from happening in the future.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. What role does the Attorney General play in this? I understand the role you play in ensuring that the mm-hmm. mechanisms are in place, but why doesn't the AG come in and do this investigation?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, they are also involved, and they get involved at that point where it becomes definitely a prosecution type matter. They take over, but they use our work in their prosecution. They don't go out and recreate the work that we've
done.
Can
I just follow this just real
Please.
Quick? So the process begins, an employee, somebody calls up and gives a tip. You folks come in, start the process. It gets handed off to or myriad up with perhaps state police or AG, mm-hmm. and then the AG takes your work and continues it.
That's correct.
That's a fair depiction. Okay.
Madam Chair, may I ask one question?
Representative Ivaki, and then we'll come back to you, Mr. McBush.
Is it the local law enforcement that's actually pursuing the crime, and is the AG's role more to figure out how to defend the state from liability, or is the AG's office also looking? You use the word prosecute. I don't think of the AG's office as prosecuting state employees.
Madam Chair, Representative Vakian, it depends on the case itself, and because there is a role sometimes in prosecuting by the Attorney General's office. Many times we're working with the local district attorney on these cases.
Mr. McGuire.
Madam Chair, for the record, Patty McGuire, Deputy Secretary of State. I think there are two drivers on the input side that I want to just mention quickly. One is the data mining tools that the Audits Division now has sort of opened the door for a much more data than there used to be and makes it much easier for the division to look at, for example, all state credit card purchases in mass rather than individually. And so when you do that, there are red flags that get raised and questions that arise. And so there's a whole lot more data readily available for the Audits Division to look at and, you know, paths that may or may not be fruitful in terms of people doing bad things, but things that we think are important to look at, questions that we think are important to look at. The other is that the division has significantly beefed up the Waste, Fraud, and Abuse hotline and website and made it much more user-friendly and much more responsive to people, and we think over time the number of people using that is going to increase. It used to just be that you went into a voicemail box and you left a message. Now you get to talk to a real-life human and who can ask questions, and all anonymously, but we are beginning to get significantly better information from that, and we think that will continue over time. We want to be able to have the resources to do things when, if somebody calls with a legitimate complaint or a legitimate concern, we want to be able to have the resources to look into that and follow those leads where they take us. And that's what this is about.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The real-life human, now, that's someone in your department, right? No?
Actually, Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, there are companies now that are out there that are actually hotline services. So we do have we go through, they're called National Hotline Services, that has a 24-hour-a-day phone answerer, but they go through our script and they ask the questions, and then that information comes to our office.
Where are they located? Yeah. Where are
Please.
They located?
Oh, Madam Chair, I'd have to take a look.
It
is in the United States.
that's part of it.
Not in a correctional
facility. Are they located in,
no.
in
okay.
the prison system?
Yeah.
No. Okay, but we have because we do have individuals who respond in that system. I don't know that we should have an inmate responding to a crime situation.
I think the committee, just as a matter of curiosity, I know I'm curious, I presume my colleagues are, we'd like to know New Jersey or Bangladesh or wherever.
We'll tell you.
Okay.
The next POP is a professional services POP. Remember, as we talked about yesterday, the increase in audit standards and what's the work that has to be done in order to issue our financial statement opinions has increased for us, but it's also increased for our contract auditors. Two of our largest financial statement opinion audits that we contract out are the University System Audit and Safe Corporations Audit. So the amount of work to do those audits has increased. Our audit costs have increased and at faster than the inflation rate that we put onto our audits. And then on top of that, we have that peak period in our audit cycle that we would like to have some additional contract dollars so that we can level off that peak. That's what this particular package is for.
Let me go back. You've raised the question, and I'm just going to stick with it because Senator Morissette and you had this exchange. The Moss Adams audit of the Prescription Benefits Administrator. The $75,000 that you made reference to, did you scope that all at once? Were you able to anticipate when you went out for bid that $100,000 was going to cover it, and now you're pleasantly surprised that you're getting $25,000 and change? How did that work?
Madam Chair, we originally put this out for bid, and the bids that came back were almost three times the amount that what we had put in our budget to do this work. So we did have to go back to the drawing board and meet again with both Legislative Fiscal Office and the legislators that were interested in that area, rescope the audit, rephrase the questions, put it back out again, and then when we were able to get someone to come in at something within the budget and to answer those questions. So we did attempt to get, I guess, more out of this, and we failed.
And so when you went the second time, Moss Adams was the only responsive bidder?
Madam Chair, we had a couple firms respond, but they were the most qualified and they had the best price when those two were put together.
Okay, so I help me, I'm just a little slow this morning. You first scoped it at how much, or you first went out to bid and it came back at?
Madam Chair, I'd have to go look. I believe the lowest bid was around $300,000.
Wow, and so then you went out to bid a second time. And it came back in?
Madam Chair, yeah, within our budget. And one of the things that was the first time we went out, there was an open question on the information systems and how much they could really rely on the information that was out there, because that does change the amount of audit work you need to do. And so the first time we went out, there wasn't a lot of information on what's known about the systems themselves. So the bidders were saying, we're going to have to do a whole bunch of work to assess the reliability of those systems.
I mean, that seems, forgive me, kind of like a no-brainer. To an open-ended question like that, was it a surprise to you that the bids were that high?
Madam Chair, actually, we were surprised that they did come back that high. We thought that the firms would do a little bit more work as far as figuring out what is already known about those systems before bidding. So, you know, they were saying without a lot of work, you know, we think we're going to need to do a whole bunch of work to get there. And so we went in and did a little bit of work to find out what was known already about the systems and then put it back out to bid with that known information.
And you had adequate resources in your budget to cover this?
I'm sure we shifted resources from other areas to get it done.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you. But then you ended up asking additional questions that Moss Adams didn't cover. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, we have additional questions that have not been answered yet. And so we have that in our audit queue as one of the potential audit topics that we might take on ourselves, because those questions, you know, piqued our interest as we were out there.
But I guess what you're saying is that you, Moss Adams, did not include all of the types of questions that you thought were important, is what you're saying, right?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, Moss Adams answered the questions that the legislative partners that we were working at, the way that they phrased those questions. During the course of us getting to know the system, we identified, you know, maybe there is a better question out there.
Okay. So it wasn't Moss Adams' fault that they didn't ask the right questions.
That's correct.
They answered the questions that
was
asked. Okay. Thank you. So so they learn from you now. You should charge
we
them.
Learn from them.
Okay, but
sounds like we paid. Okay, please continue.
Madam Chair, the next pop is our K-12 auditing. That is one where, as you all know, it used to be majority local funds running schools and local control over those funds, and that has shifted. We see this as an area that is high priority for some need for some fiscal accountability. There's no one out there doing this right now, and we have put forth this proposal to have some performance audits done at the school district level. We have modified this proposal down to $500,000. What we're hoping to do is maybe use this next interim as a pilot project where we can go out and do this work and show that the value of the work that can be done, and then come back next session with another proposal.
Unless he raises it because he has his hand up, I'm going to take his question and then steal a page out of his book. This committee ranked this low, and I'd like to invite any comment that would edify us. I mean, I think we were unanimous in ranking this low. But let's go to Representative Smith's question, and then I want to come back and visit with that.
Well, I think you
stole it.
Great. Grab my question.
Well, because I paid attention in your other committee.
I'm sure this is one of those high priorities, I know, for the Secretary of State. The state does send lots and lots of money, as you all know, to K-12 school, and there is absolutely no review or monitoring of the use of those funds to see if things can be done more efficiently, more effectively, and whether there are some best practices out there that school districts can learn from each other. And so our proposal for this particular kinds of audit work would be twofold. Part of it would be looking at, say, a topic area, construction management, because we're always building new school buildings. Take a topic area like that and look at a couple school districts that are currently doing that. Do some audit work and look for both best practices and opportunities for improving the construction in school districts, something that all of the school districts would be able to benefit from the results of those findings. And then kind of the second piece of it is we wanted to have available for school boards, superintendents, a resource that they could come to if we laid out a laundry list of different kinds of audit topics that we could address, that they could then come and request from us an audit at an area that they may be struggling with. So that's how we see kind of using these funds, is in those two different areas.
Madam Chair, might I just add a comment? You know, I started my work in the legislature in 1981, and at that time,
Representative Smith wasn't born.
Two-thirds of the money for local schools came from local property taxes, and one-third came from the state. That ratio is exactly the opposite now. Two-thirds of the money for local schools comes from state school support. And it just seems fundamental to me that with that much state money flowing to local districts, there's a real opportunity for us to provide some real assistance and accountability to local school districts. And I think Ms. Polino has laid out kind of the approach we want to take, which is really, you know, it's not so much to go into an individual school district and point fingers. It's to really go into a series of school districts and figure out best practices and to provide a service to the superintendents in various school districts who could benefit from getting a good management roadmap for their school district from an audit. So I just think it's pretty, if you look at our record, in terms of performance auditing, which is what we're really talking about here, if you look at our record, we spend a dollar and we find eight potential dollars in savings. So I think that makes a whole lot of sense for this huge expenditure of state money, that there's no accountability from the state level in terms of the expenditure of those funds.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. I'm still open on this. What I'm struggling with are the mechanics, and so let me throw those out, and perhaps you can share with the chair, who can disseminate it to all of us, the issues I'm struggling with.
First and foremost is the separation between you folks and our superintendent of education. The second is the role that the Department of Education, from my understanding, and I've never served on an ed committee, so I may be wrong. Again, these are just the issues I have, is the role they ought to be playing in doing this and the money we're paying them. The third issue, and again, I'm shooting from the hip on these, I'm just laying these out, is we got this from Ted, and I'm not an attorney, but it talks about that there may be a constitutional issue about having the Secretary of State audit local government. And from my understanding, school boards constitute local government. And so I don't expect an answer today, but if you could help me with those three areas.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, let's see if I can do it very briefly.
Okay.
We have had many discussions with the superintendent of schools about this. Their main focus is on the curriculum and inside the classroom end of K through 12 education. Our focus is completely on the opposite side, which is the business processes administration piece of it, not the class. We want to stay out of the teaching and the curriculum and the education side of it and focus just on the construction, the payroll, the processing, purchasing, those types of items. And so they see it as a very good marriage for their where they're headed with what they're doing.
Then why wouldn't they want to buy it as fee for service? If, as the Secretary says, this is of value, it would identify best business practices, you hold your service out for purchase, why wouldn't they just naturally come and buy it from you if they were desirous of having the information?
Madam Chair, it's possible that some will, and we're hoping that some will come and ask for that help. But usually these aren't things that they anticipate at the time of their budgets. You know, some issues have come up, like very recently at Union Baker. And, you know, I don't think they anticipated any additional or extraordinary audit costs at the time. But I think the bigger piece of this is that we're looking at taking those cross-cutting issues that all school districts will benefit from, not just the one or two that we happen to go through during the course of the audit. So we're hoping that by taking this and funding it, you know, out of that school fund before it gets distributed, all school districts will benefit, and they won't all bear the large financial burden that they didn't anticipate at the start. You know, when we do our audit work, one of the luxuries we have is we get all of the school district financial statements come to our office. I mean, we are the keeper of those resources. So we have a tremendous amount of data about expenditures, and we can look for risk patterns and things within the data and then target those areas for further review. So that's what we hope to do with this, is take some of the information we have available, identify some topic areas that cross, you know, whether it's high food service cost per student or whatever it might end up being, and then use that to take those topic areas and look for best practices and opportunities. So,
Senator Morissette and then Representative McLaughlin.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I you convinced me. Yesterday I raised the question about, you know, whether or not you should take money from them for doing something they don't want to have done. I see you're taking the $500,000 out of the school fund before it's distributed to the audits. Okay, that's fine. Number two, I don't think a school district would come forward and request your best practices audit if they didn't want to. I mean, maybe they don't want that kind of investigation of that particular school district. So I see that as even more important, that you do the cross-the-board audit on best practices. And thirdly, if you indeed audit nonprofits for proper use of spending state money, you certainly have the authority to audit the school district for the huge amount of money that they're getting, and what you're doing is looking at best practices. I think that's great. Now, that puts a whole new light on the school audit that I didn't have before. And so, having been on the Education Committee since I've been in the legislature and having been in the school district most of my life, I understand the importance of best practices at a very high level, because not all school districts have that efficiency mode that we hope that they would have. They are elected. It is a local control to a point,
you can make the argument that we are now the school board. We provide, you know, 70% of the funding. And so I think we have an obligation to look at best practices. So I think it's, so I changed my ranking from a low to a high.
I have a little bit different opinion than that about our role, but in that I think it's our job to cut the check, and I think it's the school board that's accountable to the public more than we are. But and that said, schools have a real mixture between state money, local property tax money, federal money, and more corporate and individual donations. And I'm wondering how you're anticipating segmenting out the state money that you're going to audit, which you seem to have a constitutional authority to do, or in what way are you going to get the school districts to allow you to audit everything?
Madam Chair, Representative Vakian, the legislation we have would give very clearly, we currently have the authority to audit state money in schools. But as you just so effectively said, there are a lot of different sources of money in a school, and it's impossible to figure out how much of the money in a, like, funding transportation comes from property taxes, comes from the state, comes from the federal government. It's just, it's pointless. The point is you want to be able to audit schools. So we have legislation that says, that gives us the authority, clear authority, to audit all sources of funds in the school. Because we clearly now do have the constitutional authority to audit state money in schools, but it's really, it's kind of a pointless exercise to separate basic school support from property taxes since nobody else does. So that's what the legislation does, is to basically be clear that we can audit all funds.
And Madam Chair, that is a bill that we have that has passed out of the Senate General Government Committee, and it was referred to Ways and Means. So it's a bill that kind of is hooked onto that option package. So I'm sure you'll be seeing it.
Senator Morris, then Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you elaborate a little bit on the kinds of audits that districts do? Are they a full certified audit, or are they reviews, or and to what extent would you be doubling up with what is already happening?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, right now the school districts receive financial statement opinion audits, which are strictly those financial audits, looking at their financial statements, are they fairly presented? And there's also a piece to that where, because our office oversees these audits, where they do some work at validating the ADM numbers, that drive the amount of money that they receive. So there is some work done by those CPA firms looking at their formula funding factors that come back to the state. But that's the extent of it. There isn't any process to look at, you know, construction programs, food service, transportation, information systems. All of that is left up to the individual school districts.
Simply, Madam Chair, Senator Moore, simply put, local CPAs do financial audits of schools now. We're not seeking to do those financial audits. We're seeking to do performance audits that can provide some help and direction to school districts to run more efficiently and effectively.
So in terms of a real-life example, Union Baker ESD, their financial audit would reflect the fact that their airplane was paid for appropriately. A performance audit might question the need for an airplane.
You want one member's opinion?
I'll give you another one. How many districts are you aware of that have internal auditors that are now looking for exactly these kinds of efficiencies?
Madam Chair, I'm only aware of, I believe, two that I know of. Portland Public Schools just hired our audit manager to become their internal auditor. And I think there is one other school district that I know of that has one. But generally speaking, I mean, this was new to Portland Public Schools, which is such a large and, they need that work very, very much. So there's not a lot of it out there.
Senator Morse.
I hope you're not forgetting the charter schools, right?
Charter
because
schools
public money
of.
Passes through to the charter schools, and the appropriate mm-hmm. use of charter school money is important.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Oh, no. Thank you, Chair Johnson. I'm not looking for additional work nor additional meetings, but I feel like I'm kind of watching the early parts of a horses racing, if you will, at the racetrack, and I don't know which horse to bet on or how to determine which horse to bet on. And let me share with you what I'm thinking about. We've got several issues floating around this building, including LFO taking a greater role in audits, this issue, et cetera. And I want to make a decision based on merit, not on who has the prettiest horse, if you will. And I don't know how to handle.
You bet on the jockey.
Bet on the jockey. My strategy's always been to wait for the horse that poops before the race, and then I know.
I'm going to move us on from the esoteric of paramutual wagering.
But I don't know where I'm going with this. What the Secretary of State is proposing, to me, has tremendous merit. I get that. But at the same time, to me, it seems like we ought to have all the folks who also have their ideas and bring them forward and listen. On this one, I'd love to hear from our superintendent of education and have her say, boy, this is terrific. This is exactly what we need. I'd like to have LFO, Ken Rocco, come up and say his take on it. And then at least as a member of the committee, I'd feel like I understand the options before us. So.
Mr. Secretary.
I just was going to say, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, it's my understanding that Susan Castillo is very, very supportive of this proposal. Now, she's not here right today saying that, but...
But you feel comfortable.
We've had conversations. And she's certainly indicated her support for the proposal.
Thank you for your suggestion, and I'm going to ask the professional staff to capture it. I'm not quite sure how to respond to it right now, but having the opportunity to sort of vet these proposals might be very meritorious. As long as we're... Are you close to the end?
I am very close, because we have one option package that we're pulling that is left. So.
Well, why don't you discuss that one with us?
The last one is that independent legal counsel. We did, as part of our last peer review, we received a comment from the National State Auditors Association about our use of Department of Justice as our legal counsel. We are working with them to come to an agreement on how we can, in those cases where they provide advice to an agency and then we come in later and audit a way for us to get some independent legal advice. So we're working on an agreement with them. So we would like to, at this point, pull this proposal off the table, and we will continue conversations with them on that.
Just as a little process check, we were noticed for a public hearing today. I believe that there's a sign-up sheet in the back of the room. I want to leave ample time to make sure that the public has the opportunity to be heard. Depending on who has signed up at this point, if anyone, I would either invite the public testimony right now at the halfway point, or if you have come specifically to speak to issues that have to do with archives or elections, we'd leave ample time at the end. But I want to make sure that the public has an opportunity to be heard. We have two people signed up. I think both of you were sitting right there. I would welcome what you'd like to do at this point. You want to testify now, or you want to wait until? Okay, that's fine. I just want to make sure we accommodate the public.
Could I ask one more question?
Please.
Before they walk out the door? I'd like to get some information about the charter school / homeschool, if there is any money into homeschool. I think that if they go to a public school to take a class. But I'm interested in, if you're auditing schools, you've got to follow the money to its extent. So if you can give me information about
yep.
the charter school, homeschool.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, that's on our list, and we're actually starting looking at statewide review of that at the request of the Department of Education. They have some concerns that came out of one of the school districts that we were investigating on the other side. Some problems came up, and so we are launching a statewide look at that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Polino. I'm going to invite Mr. Limbeck, Director of the Elections Division, to come forward. And again, process-wise, it is my intention, regardless of how far we get in your presentation, to break at 10:15 and make sure that the two witnesses that have signed up have an opportunity to address the committee. Unless you're here for the archivist and we can put you over until tomorrow, I just want to make sure that I'm accommodating to the fact that you're here. Okay. With that, good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm pleased this morning to open with just a few brief comments relating to the Elections Division and then answer all of your questions to the best of my ability. The Elections Division has five main tasks, enforcing the conduct of election statutes, administration and enforcement.
Mr. Limbeck, I'm going to ask that you indicate your name for the record, please.
I'm John Limbeck, Director of Elections, Secretary of State's Office. The Elections Division has five tasks. We enforce the conduct of election statutes. We administer and enforce Oregon's campaign finance laws. We administer the initiative and referendum process in Oregon. We publish and distribute state voters pamphlets. And we try to keep Oregon in compliance with federal election laws, such as the National Voter Registration Act and the new Help America Vote Act, which you've been hearing so much about of late. The Elections Division in 2004 functioned well during the most stressful presidential general election in history. The scrutiny on county election offices and the division was unprecedented. I just cannot tell you how difficult it was on some days. Twice, for example, during the election cycle, we had observers in our office during the processing of petition sheets. And the observers stood behind each one of my employees and watched them key in information into our elections business system. Needless to say, the stress in the room was palpable. But we survived without any major controversies or ugly and litigious recounts. I get asked all the time about whether Oregon could survive the scrutiny that Washington is undergoing. And I'd like to think that we could, but we are doing all we can to address with the counties the kind of issues that can rise up in a heated recount situation. But it will take some work and some studying of exactly what happened in Washington and why, and we are going to be doing so in the coming months. The Elections Division continues to be managed tightly so that we can make optimum use of our 15 general funded employees. Employees are given a primary task assignment, but are expected to learn the business of the entire division. Although we have roughly half the staff with the primary task assigned to the campaign finance team, all staff members are assigned to assist with reviewing the thousands of C&E reports that are filed with the division in a two-year cycle. In July of an even-numbered year, the entire staff is assigned to assist with the processing of initiative petition sheets. Work on the voters pamphlet is accomplished through the work of a manager and two employees whose primary tasks fall elsewhere. I mention this because this is a way of making optimum use of our staff, and it has served Oregon taxpayers well through the years. The division has been managed that way and was managed that way long before I got here in 2001. I took a look and was impressed with the way it's been managed and have just tried not to screw it up since I got here.
It's a laudable goal.
I firmly believe that the taxpayers are getting their money's worth with these 15 general funded positions, and I mention this to you because I want to make you aware that if reductions are necessary to my division, they would affect all of the functions of the office, not just one. During this election cycle, the Elections Division accomplished had some highlights, I thought. I just thought I'd mention a couple of them. Once again, we assisted committees with compliance of the new statutory requirements for electronic filing CNE reports. I think all of you may remember that at the beginning of the election cycle, we made a transition where electronic filing for those campaign committees that had in excess of $50,000 in financial activity was no longer an option. It became a requirement. And it required us to do a lot of training, hand-holding, getting people through a transition process, and I think the division did that job fairly well. For the 2004 primary, 142 committees filed their election reports electronically. For the general election, 194 committees filed electronically, which represents about 45% of the filings for the period. We also implemented a new electronic filing system for state candidates. In case any of you didn't know, and when you're contemplating filing for re-election, you can now do that online. A website.
Miss all that drama?
Yeah, well, you can have a little drama of your own. A website was created, and candidates filled out the appropriate form and paid the appropriate fee. We had a total of 69 candidates, 22% of the 313 candidates who filed to run in the 2004 primary election used this new service. And the website is up once again, and you can file for office at any time that you want to for the current election cycle online, conveniently, from wherever you are. The Elections Division reviewed almost 4,100 campaign contribution and expenditure reports during the past cycle. With a few notable exceptions, we were successful this election cycle in assisting committees with clearing up disclosure problems quickly, so that fines can be kept at minimum levels. We often, once in a while, take a few barbs because we issue so many small fines. And I tell people, that's a sign of success. It is not a sign of failure. The division has been managed through the years from a philosophy that the first priority when there's a problem is to assist the committee with quickly complying with the law. Fines and enforcement come later. And, of course, the faster you comply, the lower your fine. And so if you look at our list of fines, and they are also all online, you'll see the vast majority of them are pretty tiny. And that's a sign of success, and that the division has assisted people in spotting problems early, allowing them to disclose, to get to full disclosure early, and avoid a sizable fine. We also produced voters' pamphlets that were timely, accurate, and produced and distributed at reasonable costs.
Before, Ms. Lundbeck, we move on to the voters' pamphlet, in the phase ones, I had raised the question, and I've raised it with you privately about this letter that's floating around with respect to the potential to download CNEs and manipulate the data and somehow put it back. I believe you've seen the letter. And I'd like to end that conversation sort of once and for all. Do you have a dispositive response?
I think so. We'll test it out here and see how dispositive it is. First of all, we do not see a potential for that happening and somebody getting away with it.
Those are two different things.
I know, and if you'd allow me to elaborate on that. Somebody could try. Let's say they filed a false report on behalf of another candidate. And I have to mention here that the FEC has had electronic filing for many, many, many years, and they've never had an incident of this kind. And we were trying to figure out when we were looking at this letter what the motivation somebody would have for filing a false campaign report, because the one from the candidate, the correct one, would arrive eventually, and we would have two reports, and would raise a question. Why would we have two reports?
But meantime, the Oregonians printed the headline, Candidate X Receives Contribution from American Nazi Party. The damage is done.
Well, they could do that on paper now. We have a paper filing system now, and there is nothing to keep somebody from filing a false paper report. We've never had that happen. And so they're really, I think the inference here was that this electronic filing system has created a potential for some sort of shenanigans that didn't exist before, and that's just not true. Whenever we look at these things, and whenever we get questions about computer security, and we have lots of firewalls and that kind of thing, that for security reasons, I can't talk about in a public meeting. But if you are allowed to meet in private, we could go through all the details and what our firewalls are and our protections against that are against this kind of thing, people being able to get into our data and manipulate it. We just don't see that as possible, and we could provide that information to you in some sort of confidential atmosphere, but we can't do it in a public meeting. Which brings us down to this inference that somebody could file a false report. Again, our response is, if they tried that, it wouldn't take very long before the true one comes in. And second, they can do that now with paper filing. And I don't know if that's dispositive or not, Madam Chair, but...
To be truthful with you, it isn't. I would welcome the opportunity to work with the professional staff to figure out how we get an answer to that letter. I think for folks that are out on the front lines of campaigns, having any suggestion that your systems could be breached in any way is worrisome. And as I think all of us know, campaigns have gotten uglier and meaner and more sophisticated, and I think just looking for a level of reassurance, the letters seem to open the door to some questions. You're indicating, and I think appropriately, that there are some security procedures you don't want to discuss in a public meeting, and I think that's appropriate, but it may be an issue that we want to revisit again. What I heard was nobody'd ever do it. If you did do it, you'd get caught. I haven't heard that we have adequate firewalls to prevent this from ever happening. And maybe I'm asking for too much. I don't know, but that's the piece that's missing for me.
I do think we have firewalls that would make it extremely difficult. But I can turn to this committee and say it absolutely could not happen at any time. I can't tell you that.
Well, yeah, NORAD doesn't think their systems can get hacked, and somewhere out there there's some sophomore in high school who's working on it right now.
I couldn't make that promise to you. But we do think... We can tell you, and again, this would be the kind of information on the details of which we'd rather not, we don't think we can discuss publicly, that we do have firewalls that would make it extremely difficult, and that that to the extent that somebody was able to do it, it would be very hard to do it and get away with it.
Let's Representative Bakken.
If is the issue that you want public access immediately at the time of filing? If that's not the issue, it certainly seems that if the public only had access to the information at the deadline for filing, then you would know that there were two reports filed and you could catch virtually any type of breach of the system unless the candidate failed to file by the deadline, which I would assume... normally doesn't happen. Just a thought. Don't need you to comment unless you want to.
Let's move on.
Okay. I wanted to talk to you about voters' pamphlets.
Representative Smith.
I apologize. I didn't realize we're going to voters' pamphlet right now. I don't have the exact name of the money that's coming, but there's a large chunk of federal dollars coming to the state of Oregon. Is that an issue that's, and I guess I'm turning to Monica as well, is that an issue that's addressed in this budget, or is that an issue we'll be addressing at some point if the money arrives?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I presume you're talking about the Help America Vote Act money,
the
potential for $17.9 million additional dollars. There are policy packages within the requested budget that address not only the matching funds but the additional resources. Now, whether those address CNE reports for the Help America Vote.
Okay.
And so those will be in future packages.
We'll get to that as we move into the policy option packages.
Okay.
We have a policy option package with a $700,000 price tag on it
that triggers a $17 million-plus inflow of federal money to help facilitate the Oregon's implementation of the Help America Vote Act. And that speaks, I think, to the purchase of voting devices for persons with disabilities. It speaks to centralized voter registration, to a bunch of stuff that I would anticipate Mr. Winbeck covering in his presentation.
Okay, one last.
Representative Smith.
Right now is probably not the right time, but both the House and the Senate are working on campaign finance reform. I would hope that when the time's appropriate, you folks can share with whatever, and I know it's not today, but when the time's appropriate, whatever's going to be coming forward, whatever's going to be implemented, you can share with this committee and the fiscal requirements that you folks are going to be faced with on that.
We're going to ask Mr. Limbach to do that. It covers stuff that we discussed yesterday after the House had gone.
Okay.
That includes things that are of particular interest to me about whether or not we're going to try with this federal money to standardize the devices in each one of the counties, whether that's a clerk's decision, whether or not there are cost savings by having 36 of the same machines that can be serviced from the same spare stock, can be serviced by the same technician familiar with dealing with the XYZ company's device, versus letting the clerks select their own county by county, and I don't know how many manufacturers are in this universe. I presume they're not 36, but do we have five different machines scattered through 36 counties? And
okay,
those sorts of things, and we'll cover those, I hope, in depth before Mr. Lindbeck leaves us.
Perfect. Madam Chair.
Representative Crump.
Thanks. John, share with me in relation to Oregon's vote by mail statute how that works with provisional ballots.
Well, a provisional ballot is a ballot in which somebody shows up and says, I didn't get my ballot at home. They make a call. And the county says, well, you're not on our list. You're not on our voter registration list. They're required now under federal law to let that person vote what is called a provisional ballot. And they collect information from the person and have them fill out a voter registration card and collect whatever information. I'm talking about the county. Then they are given up to 10 days after the election to try to figure out whether the fact that this person wasn't on the list was at the fault of the county and they should have been on the list, or if there's some other problem where they are indeed a legally registered voter in that jurisdiction and that vote should count. But that vote is not counted, that provisional ballot is not counted until there's a determination made by the county clerk that they are indeed legally registered and qualified to vote for that election.
I'm Chair Fowler.
Follow-up.
As you know, one of the controversies in the Washington gubernatorial election is the admitted counting of provisional ballots by more than one county, primarily King County, as I understand it.
Yeah,
and I think there were a few in two other counties. How do you as an organization audit, and did you audit provisional ballot counting to make sure that what happened in Washington State did not or does not happen here in Oregon in accordance with federal law?
Madam Chair and Representative Krupp, my understanding of what happened in Washington is that it was a polling place problem, that you had polling place workers who the voter showed up at the polling place, said, I want to vote. They said, you're not on the list. Here, fill out this provisional ballot. The voter filled out the provisional ballot, then walked over to the precinct counter machine in the polling place and put the ballot into the precinct counter machine, and in effect got counted before that process happened, where they were able to make a determination on the qualification of the voter, which happens back at central headquarters. We don't have polling places here. which solves that problem. We don't have voters putting their own ballots into the machines. Our votes are all tallied on central count machines. And so when that provisional ballot is handled in Oregon, it's placed in an envelope at the central headquarters, and it is set aside for the clerk to make that determination later about eligibility. And so the voter doesn't have that opportunity to run over and put their ballot in the machine.
And Madam Chair, so do you audit to make sure that these are in fact counted properly then at each county? So in other words, do you call each county or talk to the county clerks and say, how many provisional ballots did you have? Are you sure none of them were counted prior to verification under the federal law?
We do not right now go into each county and look at every decision made about every provisional ballot. The counties are required under the new federal law to report to us the number of provisional ballots they had, how many of them were counted, and how many were not counted. Interestingly, also another provision of the Help America Vote Act is that the voters themselves must be given access to a 1-800 number so that they can call their county elections office and find out whether or not their provisional ballot got counted. And we do have that service in Oregon.
And last question.
Last one.
Sure, thank you. One of the other controversies out of Washington State is more votes being cast in a county than there are registered voters. Okay. Do we have that happen here in Oregon? Do you track that?
The county clerks have the responsibility for the reconciliation of the number of votes cast against the activity in their voter registration system. Let me give you an example of
activity.
Yeah, and I think this is what was going on in Washington. I think I can elaborate a little bit more on it. In each county you have a voter registration system that tracks the ballots when they go out. It says, Representative Krupp has been issued a ballot. And then when it comes back, it tracks that the ballot was logged in, and we know that they've got it. Then the next thing we know, we have a count in a tally system that's separate from the voter registration system. The counties are to, in their reconciliation process and prior to certifying their results to us, are to reconcile the number of votes recorded against the activity, for example, the number of ballots logged back in. Now, there is going to be a slight difference, because there are some envelopes that are going to come back, frankly, that don't have a ballot in them. And by the time you figure that out, you don't know whose it is, because we have secrecy of the ballot, so you can't go back and at the time you discover that secrecy envelope is open and there's no ballot in it. Or they return a ballot that's blank, and it's more common than you think.
But Madam Chair,
there can be slight differences in the reconciliation, but the counties are to look at that.
But John, what you've just described, and I'm sure it happens, that would result in under vote. What I'm talking about is an over vote, mm-hmm. where you actually get more ballots back than you sent out. Does that happen in Oregon?
Well, I'm not aware of it happening anywhere. I'm sure that if a county discovered that in their certification process, they'd be calling us and say, what do we do? we've not been alerted to any situation like that.
There are situations where voters are issued more than one ballot. In fact, in almost every case, there are going to be more ballots issued than there are voters, because people lose their ballot, people come in and get a replacement ballot. There are systems in place to prevent two ballots from a voter being counted, and protocols established on a statewide basis to make sure that doesn't happen. But there will, in fact, be fairly regular situations where there are more ballots out there than there are voters.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you. Would that be college students who are registered in their home county and who go to the university in Eugene or Corvallis or somewhere else and re-register, can they get two ballots under the existing system?
Well, they could get two ballots. They would report but of course there only one can be counted. Now it's possible that they could be issued two ballots. That happens with people who either move close to an election time where they got sent a ballot to their old address, but they've moved, and because ballots are not forwardable, then those ballots are returned by the post office to the county. But technically, they would have been issued a ballot in their old county, and they may. And you can update your registration in Oregon right up through election day. So, let's say that it's in the week before an election, and I move from. I live in Marion County in Representative Krupp's district. I moved to Polk County, close to the election. My ballot may have been sent to my state and address and returned by the post office because I wasn't there, but I could update my registration right up to election day in Polk County and have them issue me a ballot there. Does that make sense?
I guess the central statewide system would count, that would cover those, but I could see a person going home for the weekend, picking up their ballot, filling it out, mailing it in, going back to another city, getting another ballot and mailing it in. Now, would they be caught, so to speak?
They could be caught. They may not be caught. That's sort of one of the vulnerabilities of our system that makes the centralized voter registration system so important that we're currently creating with the help of Help America Vote Act.
I can't figure out how you would get more ballots than there were voters, though. In our system, I
live in Chicago. as interesting as this is, I just want to give everybody a little process check. We have one more day with the Secretary of State. We still have to do corporations. We have to do Help America Vote, and we have to do archives. Plus, have time for public testimony. So I'm going to ask Mr. Lindback to continue on. You may be on notice that we'll see you again in the morning, but we got to have our track shoes on tomorrow to get through the rest of all of these pieces.
Madam, last comment on this subject. My stepson, in the 2000 presidential election, received three ballots from three different counties in the state of Oregon. He only voted once.
Let's hope he's a registered Democrat.
He's a Republican.
But we got to get office right away.
No partisanship here.
Mr. Lindback, I'm going to ask you to pay special attention to this three-ballot anomaly. Mr. McGuire, you had a comment, and then we're going to move on.
The only thing I would add is the Information Systems Division is also on your to-do list.
Oops. Okay, that makes the problem worse. Mr. Lindback, please continue.
Okay, well, I wanted to brag a little bit about the voters. I was trying to get into it. We produced, printed, and delivered more than 8 million voters' pamphlets in five statewide elections in the past election cycle, including a two-volume voters' pamphlet for the 2004 general election that contained 8 ballot measures, 342 arguments, and 253 candidates. We provided cost per page information to you that we think is reasonable, but I want to take a second to brag just about one thing. We've always had a low error rate in these voter pamphlets in terms of printing mistakes and distribution problems, but in this past election cycle, for the general election pamphlet, we did not have one single error. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't typos, but those are candidate-created things that we can't fix. As you know, we're restricted in the law about things that we can fix and we can't fix. But not one single error, and it just was so astounding. Our employee who does this is a longtime employee named Tammy Detweiler, who works very hard on this project. And we often get questions about, have you ever thought about contracting out for this process? The division did contract out for that process some years back, and it turned out to be so much more expensive than just doing it in-house. They brought it back in-house, and it's stayed there ever since.
Well, you have found all kinds of economies. The fact that the margins are narrower, the fact that I think it was last cycle or cycle before, you peeled $750,000 off the cost of producing a cherished piece of Oregon's elections. And I think you've done remarkable stuff. You get the type any smaller, though, and for some of us that are part of the boomer generation, it will be indecipherable. But you're doing remarkable work with that document.
Yeah, and Secretary Bradbury touched on this during phase one, but I just wanted to mention this thing. It sort of bugged me that we were presenting this chart to you about cost per page, because that's good to always, of course, look at things from the standpoint of cost per unit. But the fact is, just because we produce a cheap document doesn't make it the best document or the most readable document for the voters. And we've had design experts look at our voters pamphlet and suggest design changes because they think it needs some changes. I talk to groups all the time who just tell me the book is too hard, too big, and too hard to navigate. But the money situation has just precluded us from even looking at that kind of project. And I would love to do that project someday, and it would involve spending more money on the pamphlet, but it would be a huge voter service. So I just want to mention that today.
Representative Smith.
I'll use discretion with future questions, but I have two quick ones. How do you determine whether it's an R or D on a page?
An R or D on a page.
You've got two columns. You're running the two candidates. Uh-huh. How do you decide who gets the inner, who gets the outer? Who gets the outer, who gets the inner?
You know, can I get back to you on that? I can't remember. There is a method to the madness.
Just let me know.
Yeah.
Second question, and then I will use complete discretion. Some of us won the Republican and the Democratic nomination, received two certificates. Does that mean we can go to either caucus?
I've been asking that question myself since I'm in the same position.
The answer is no.
Oh. Yeah, Representative Smith, as much as I'd like to set the rules for the legislature,
I want
to pick the caucus that had my issue at hand.
The Senate would like you to know that you're welcome anytime.
Okay. I need to know the name. How do you spell Cammie's last name?
Detweiler.
Oh, Detweiler. Okay.
Detweiler. My last subject area I want to touch on.
Before you move on, Representative Krupp.
Thank you. Regarding the future technology, and 74% of Oregon homes are wired to the Internet now, what about just doing this online and having a very limited printing to those individuals who want it?
We have looked at that. We've gotten this question over the years. We do put it online. We mail one per household, as you know. And the situation with mailing it, we get a huge break on mailing costs because we mail to a household and not to a specific person. And we did some various cost analyses of these proposals in the past, and it turned out some pretty astounding things. If we just mailed to, say, the half of the population that expressed that they truly wanted it, it would cost us more money to mail to those specific people than to just simply mail one to each household. And so... The mailing costs are a huge factor in the overall cost of this endeavor, and we've gone through various analyses and jumped through various hoops and find that we can't seem to get it done any cheaper than mailing to the household.
Well, Madam Chair, that would beg the question then, if you have individuals in households who wanted the paper, why couldn't you just mail one to those numbers of households, not individuals, like you do now, but just reduce the number to those households that want them? Would that still not drop your overall cost? I would still think you'd get a good rate, wouldn't you?
We could do that, but you're still mailing it to a specific address. And the cost per mailing every time you do that is significantly higher than if you deliver them to the post office and say one per household, and they don't worry about what the address is.
And in addition, you have the cost of people answering the phone saying, I want a voter's pamphlet, the mail cost of some sort of solicitation as to whether you want a mailed voter's pamphlet or not, the additional processing cost in a mail room to apply labels. There are a lot of additional costs that go into keeping track of individual voters. And in addition, prior to the development of the centralized voter registration system, the state has not had a list of voters. We will beginning January 106, so we haven't even had a statewide list of voters. We would have had to depend upon 36 counties to keep track of this and then merge those lists together. And so, I mean, I think as we are moving forward with centralized voter registration, this is worth another look, but the economies of scale are not crystal clear on this.
Senator Morissette.
Can't you use the federal money then to upgrade the voter pamphlet as part of your total upgrade of Vote America? Seems to me you should be able to do that.
Answer that question. We did use federal money in part for designers to look at the voter's pamphlet and suggest to us some design changes to make it more voter friendly. We cannot use federal money to pay for the printing and the distribution. You cannot use federal money to sort of backfill and pay for something that you're already doing.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, so the last subject area I wanted to generally touch on was investigations. We continue to see a steady increase in the number of investigations of all types that we do. One of the factors that work in this is that, thanks in part to all of you folks, we're having more and more elections, such as statewide special elections. You keep calling them. We had five elections in the last election cycle. Which is a substantial workload on the system. But we've seen the number of complaints rise from 383 in 1997 to 1998 to 2,027 in 2003 and 2004. During that time, we've had no increase in staff to handle that workload increase. I'm particularly frustrated about how long it takes to move on important initiative and referendum fraud cases, which is why we submitted a POP on that issue. And we asked for an investigator on that. And here's the situation. We've got currently 36 initiative and referendum fraud complaints that we're trying to investigate from the 2003 and 2004 election cycle. And we've gotten one to the point of prosecution. And here's what happens. We do whatever work we can, absent a full-time investigator to work on these kinds of cases. It gets forwarded to the Criminal Justice Division, where these cases compete with murders, violent crimes, and that kind of thing. They get to them eventually, but I got a letter yesterday on a case that's 10 months old. They finally got to it, and the guy's gone. They can't find him. And so these investigations are not able, they're not able to pay attention to these investigations at the time when these folks, who are often pretty mobile, are still around. And we end up closing a lot of them because we just can't find the people. And in order to build and create and have public confidence in the initiative and referendum process, we wanted to be able to prove to people that we're able to do something about fraud. And I can't turn to you and say that we are able to combat fraud in this process as effectively as we would like.
With that rather dramatic ending, I'm going to just leave your testimony there, invite the two public testimony witnesses, and you're welcome to stay at the table, Mr. Secretary, if you want, or whatever suits your purposes. I'm going to also say that my intention to finish tomorrow is that we'll ask Mr. Limbeck back and do a half an hour on elections, a half an hour on Help America Vote, 15 minutes for information, 15 minutes for corporations, 15 minutes for archives, 15 minutes for public testimony, and this will adjust if there is a whole room full of public testimony. So that's the plan to keep us on schedule. And I am inviting up to the witness table simultaneously Andy Miller and Kathy Caton and ask you to present your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Eaton.
Oh, I apologize. I'm sorry.
It's my bad, right? I'm governance chair for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. We are a nonpartisan grassroots political organization that encourages citizens to participate in government and to be educated about government. And as our name implies, we're very much interested in the whole elections process, have been for 85 years now. I will be very brief. We're particularly concerned about the money for HAVA, the $700,000, which we need in hard money. The division already having, with the county clerks, put together $800,000 worth of in-kind money because we needed a $1.5 million altogether. But $700,000 is what we need for that $17 million, and that $17 million is extremely important for our centralized voter registration list and for improving the technology and the voting assistance for the disabled community. Those are two of the four major priorities for the Help America Vote Act. The other concern we have had for a long time an interest in is the voter's pamphlet. Now, it's over 100 years old. It's unique. When we visit with people across the country, they're always very much impressed with our voter's pamphlet. Why don't we have one of those in whatever state it happens to be? Because it's very important to people. And while there's been no particular poll taken, there is great evidence that the majority of voters in Oregon depend on the voter's pamphlet for their information about elections. So we are asking you to certainly fund the voter's pamphlet for the next election cycle and to provide the money for HAVA. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Eaton, for your testimony. Given that the League keeps a pretty close pulse on people's opinions about elections and the conduct of government, how do you think League members, and extrapolate that to Oregonians, would feel about an increase in the cost for arguments in the voter's pamphlet to help pay for the pamphlet? Many people think it's the best bargain in terms of election advertising that exists. There's been discussion in this building about raising the fees to be in the pamphlet. Give me your reaction on behalf of the League.
Chair Johnson, for a number of years now, the League has been advocating for the voter's pamphlet to be as self-sufficient as possible, and that would have to be done through increases in the cost to candidates and for measures. We also have been advocating for some kind of limits on the number of arguments. There are other states, Montana and California being examples, where they have limited but made sure that all the pro and con arguments were there. But they have absolutely limited the number of arguments page by page that can be presented.
How would you go about doing those limits? Let's say that I am the person making the decision. There's only five pro arguments, and the League happens to be the sixth, and you're rejected. I mean, what mechanism would you have to make sure that you got the appropriate five if that's the arbitrary limit?
Well, in Montana, as I understand the process, Madam Chair, is that the proponents and the opponents are urged to get together, and they each have a couple of pages to present their cases. And so it's up to the groups or the individuals who are supporting or opposing a particular measure to make sure that all of the arguments that they want are put forward in those two pages.
The reason I'm smiling is I'm just trying to think of the unlikely pairs that would be asked to go off in a hermetically sealed room in Oregon and come out with somebody living to offer the argument.
Right, and Montana may be unique in what it does. But the other, California allows all of the major proponents and opponents to prepare an argument, and then they are sort of telescoped. And So that the major pieces, and I don't know whether they do that, how exactly that's done, but in their voters pamphlet, the major arguments are there, and then there is a list of the individuals and the organizations which are supporting or opposing with a contact number, so that if you want more information, you could get it. That's just an example.
Any questions of Ms. Eaton? Thank you very much for coming forward. Ms. Miller.
Thank you, Chair Johnson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Miller. I'm the director of Common Cause Oregon, and I'm in the somewhat uncomfortable position of having to disagree right now with my esteemed colleague on the funding of the voters pamphlet. Common Cause strongly believes that this should be a general fund expense. It is an extremely important part of democracy. It is necessary for an informed electorate. I don't believe that you should turn the voters pamphlet into a paid circular. Again, you're putting the price of democracy on a square inch basis. How much democracy can you afford today? I think it's patently unfair and undemocratic. I can't think of anything in this system, in spite of John Wan and the investigator. I think this voters pamphlet is critical. We support the elections division, the work of the elections division. I'm very proud to be associated with this system in Oregon. I am the envy of my peers. I'm part of a national organization, and I really appreciate what they do. I am here also to reinforce now Ms. Eaton's request for have a matching fund. It's really a no-brainer. It's a huge, it's a mandate to implement HABA, and so it seems logical that we would want to take the money that they want to give us rather than pay for all those mandates ourselves.
Thank you. Any questions of Ms. Miller? You've elicited smiles from everybody surrounding you, Mr. Lewis.
They like me. They really like me.
I don't know at what rate that HABA money comes in, but it seems to me that $700,000 investment for a $17 million federal payday is certainly an appropriate ratio to put in place. That,
Madam Chair, if I could,
please, Ms. Eaton,
add a little bit to that. Oregon now is only one of five states that hasn't met the match. So 45 of the 50 states have already received their money and are busy taking care of business. So we think it's extremely important that we can move ahead with ours.
Thank you for that added piece of information. Yes. Senator Morissette.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. I don't understand why we can use HAVA money to do a study on a design and can't use it to implement the design. That's what I seem to understand from the...
I might ask Mr. Limbach to comment on that. I'm not sure either of these witnesses are prepared to answer that question. Would you mind coming forward, Ms. Limbach? Just drag another chair up.
John Limbach, Director of Elections. I think in answer to your question, generally, here's where they draw the line on these federal monies, and this is true not just with HAVA, but with other federal programs like this as well. You're allowed to use the money to meet requirements of the bill, or in some cases, such as HAVA, there's money available for the general improvement in the administration of elections, but you cannot use it to backfill for something that you're already doing. I was asked, for example, could we just use the federal money to pay for the voters pamphlet? No, we already do a voters pamphlet. We can't use it to just pay for the voters pamphlet. To the extent that we're doing something new with the voters pamphlet that would fit in under the HAVA law, we can pay for that new stuff. So, for example, we asked designers to look at the design and make recommended changes to the design. Perfectly allowable expense under the Help America Vote Act. But when it comes to printing the pamphlet and distributing it to the voters, that would need to continue to be a general fund expense. Otherwise, we're using federal funds to backfill for something that we're already doing.
May I
follow up?
Okay. It just seems to me that if you come up with a new design, is it going to cost that much more to print the new design than the old design?
Yes.
It would.
Yes.
And they won't pay for... it doesn't make sense that they won't pay for the implementation of the study that they fund, is what I'm getting at. I don't understand that.
Well,
you don't have to go into all that, but I just don't understand. And if there's a way to change their mind, I think you should. It doesn't make sense. Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments? Okay, thank you very much for coming forward. We will also be taking public testimony tomorrow, and thank you. You can just leave it there on the end of the table, and we'll make sure it gets distributed to the committee. And with that, let me just wrap up the meeting. I think, Mr. Secretary, do you have any concluding remarks for today?
No, just I'm glad to look at John. Are you finished or not?
We're back
I, we're going to ask Mr. Lindback to come back and kick off tomorrow.
Okay.
We will finish with him, and then I just jotted this down. We'll do elections for a half an hour. We're going to do HAVA for a half an hour. We will allot 15 minutes each to Information Systems Corporation, Archives, and then 15 minutes for public testimony, but adjust that if there are throngs of persons. And unless there are any final comments from the remaining committee member, any comments from the secretary or your crew, I am going to close the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 5067, the Secretary of State, and invite everybody back at 8:30, including the chairman, who again apologizes for being late. So thank you very much.
Thank you.